we're looking at how Jeremiah responded to this situation that we've just been describing. The first thing he did is a natural thing. He wanted to get to run. I mean, when you come up against anything this difficult, you want to get away. You want to change churches. Or you want to go to another occupation or do something, get away. So here is his instant reaction. Chapter 9, verse 2. Oh, that I had in the desert a wayfarer's lodging place. Of course, the King James says, in the wilderness, which is a very famous idiom. Oh, that I had in the desert an inn in the wilderness, a wayfarer's lodging place, that I might leave my people and go away from them. You notice that Jeremiah does not just want to get away. You know, a lot of times you just want to get away from people and go, you know, to some desert island or into some wilderness away from everybody. But he doesn't want to get away from people. He wants to run a resort hotel. He don't want to get away from people. So it's not that he wants to get away from people. Because of all things, he wants to run away from his lodging place where there are a lot of people all the time. So what does he want to get away from? What burdens us down is not so much people as it is responsibility. You see, he wouldn't have a responsibility for these people. They'd come there, spend the night, swap stories. He'd preach to them. They'd go on. He'd never know what effect he had on them or their lives, you know. Just like a seminar professor, you know, where you lecture and preach and the students move on and you move on. You never know, you know, what happened. And later on, you'll talk to somebody and find out what happened, good and bad. That's happened later. The responsibility of it, that's the basic difference between a pastor's and missionary's responsibility and that of a seminary professor, where we can get away as seminary professors from responsibilities, but you can never escape yours. Now, you go on a vacation, they'll call you back the next day to a funeral or something. You just can't ever get away from the responsibilities. And sometimes you just say, well, if I could just get away from those responsibilities and become a seminary professor or something, not have to deal with the problems, I'll become a counselor. And I'll start a counseling service, so I won't have any responsibility because I'll let these people make up their own minds. I won't even tell them what they're supposed to do. And so, therefore, I won't have any responsibility about what happens. So that, of course, is what you, is a natural reaction. Not so much he wants to get away from people, he just wants to get away from responsibility. A second reaction is he feels sorry for himself. He just doesn't think anybody has ever had as difficult a time as he has. In the book of Job, Job pronounces a curse on his birthday, and he wishes that no one would ever be born again on that day. But Jeremiah goes a step beyond, in which Jeremiah pronounces a curse on the man that brought the news that he was born. He says that this man ought to be stoned for a false witness. But because he brought the news to my father and said, good news, the son is born. It wasn't good news. The saddest news that's ever come to the world was the announcement that Jeremiah was born. And the man ought to be stoned as a false witness because he didn't tell the truth. He misled my people, made them think it was a good news when I was born. The saddest day in the history of the world and was when Jeremiah was born. You can see how low he is and what self-pity he has for himself. That's another way we have reacting to this. We feel sorry for ourselves. We say nobody's ever had as difficult a time as we. And then the third reaction he has is starts hating these people who are doing it to him. And there are two kinds of people doing it to him. His enemies and then God. Now, God by neglect and sometimes by persuading him to do something that was doomed to failure anyway. He sometimes is taken off on God and sometimes on his enemies. Now you can understand how he feels about God, that he's been disappointed and that God has let him down, but it's rather difficult for the Christian to defend Jeremiah's hostility toward his enemies and calling on God to wipe them out and destroy them. And perhaps we need to, we have the same sort of thing in the Psalms. We need to pause a moment to look at these imprecations, these curses against enemies that are found in the Psalms and in Jeremiah. They're primarily in 12:3, 17:18, and 18:18 and following. 12:3, 17:18, and 18:18 and following. We've seen them as we read through. Jeremiah pronounces these curses against his enemies. Several things you have to realize about this. First place is it's perfectly natural to feel this way. If somebody hurts you, you know, that you think they ought to get something in return. The animals will do this. You keep mauling an animal until he'll turn on you and give it back to you. It's a natural reaction to fight back when you're hurt. It's natural. The second thing is that the Hebrews have a problem we don't have. The Hebrews did not know that there was a meaningful afterlife. Most of them didn't realize it. Therefore, if anybody was getting what was coming to him, it had to come in this life. Now, you and I can relish the thought this person is going to bask in hell for eternity and get some satisfaction, but they didn't have that. They didn't have that satisfaction, that if a person was going to get it, he got it now. And it really was a matter of the justice of God. It had to do with this, and if God is just, then they're calling upon God to do what he's supposed to do. From everything you read about Jeremiah, you can't imagine Jeremiah himself, you know, trying to kill anybody or trying to hurt anybody. We have no record that Jeremiah ever turned on anybody, you know, and struck them. Jeremiah wouldn't do this kind of thing. He's asking God to do it, see? It's not that he would give it a thought himself, but it's God's responsibility. And God says, you know, vengeance is mine, saith the Lord. All right, if it's yours, then use it. That's quite a difference, you know, between that and taking the law in your own hands and getting your own revenge. He is really calling upon God to practice justice. Another thing you have to realize, the reason why Jeremiah felt so strongly about this is because these are people that he tried to help who have turned on him. If somebody's always been your enemy, well, you sort of understand that to be the role that you play in life. But if somebody's been your close friend and he's turned on you, your feelings are a little bit stronger. And these are people that Jeremiah prayed for, people that he was concerned about, people that he loved, and it looked like that they loved him. And finally, when you think about it, you realize that we Christians still have this problem. It's very hard, difficult for a Christian not to feel hostility to somebody that hurts him. And if we have so many problems, even though we know we aren't supposed to feel this way, then what about somebody who, by all of his training and teaching, believed it was perfectly all right to have these feelings? However, you shouldn't consider this without looking at the book of Job and seeing that the Old Testament doesn't always go this way. Turn to Job 31, which is one of the most remarkable passages in the Bible on this subject, where the writer of Job has gone beyond anything else in the Old Testament. Look at Job 31. 29, chapter 31, verses 29 and following, of Job 31 in Job's famous soliloquy. If I have rejoiced at the ruin of him that hated me, or exulted when evil overtook him, I have not let my mouth sin by asking for his life with a curse. If the men of my tent had not said, who is there that has not been filled with his meat? If I have rejoiced at the ruin of him that hated me, if I have found any satisfaction in seeing my enemy go down, or exalted when evil overtook him, I have not let my mouth sin by asking for his life with a curse. You know, that's the opposite of what Jeremiah is doing. It's the opposite of what the Psalms are doing. It shows real insight. What Job is really saying is that, you know, I'm a little bit, the writer of Job is saying it, because he's, as you well know, and you should know, in chapter 29 through 31, what Job is doing is expressing the faith of the author of the book, and the author of the book is using Job as his mouthpiece through which he can give the highest ethical ideals you have in the Old Testament. And Job becomes the means and the spirit of Job through which the writer himself gives us his own ethic. And the writer himself, now Job at the time in which he lived would probably never have had thoughts like this. It's not the time for people to think about their enemies. But this is someone who's disturbed by David's attitude toward his enemies. who's disturbed by Jeremiah's attitude, because he is saying, well, you know, Jeremiah was sinning when he said that, asking for his enemy's life with a curse. The Old Testament and songs in the Old Testament to rejoice over the fall of the enemy is a sin against God. It's just asking for trouble to have this kind of an attitude. You can see that this is really on the level of what Jesus taught, and certainly the passages even influenced the Sermon on the Mount, as you perhaps can readily see. So not all the Old Testament has this attitude. Most of it, there's one of the Proverbs, you know, that says that you're supposed to build coals of fire on your enemy rather than trying to get revenge on him. And then this particular passage in Job, where he considers Jeremiah's attitude to be downright sinful, which is very intriguing. But Jeremiah didn't see anything wrong with it. He thought it was perfectly appropriate to feel this way. And even if it wasn't appropriate, he felt that way. And since he felt that way about it, he was going to take it to God. Now, suppose you do feel that way. The book of Ephesians helps us a good deal on this. You know, Paul says, you may want to put quotes around Paul, whoever it is that wrote Ephesians. But Ephesians is Pauline, whether Paul wrote it or not. The writer of Ephesians makes this interesting remark about this kind of situation. He says, be angry, which is an imperative. You're supposed to be angry. Be angry, he says, just like he says, be filled with the Holy Spirit. Be angry. There's something wrong with you if you don't get upset about some of the things that people do or say. Be angry. Nothing wrong with getting angry. Be angry, but be sure you don't sin when you get angry. Of course, there are two ways that you sin when you get angry. Number one, when you get angry over something that's not justify anger. And most of the time when we get upset, it's over things that are not appropriate causes for it. And Jesus reminds us about that. He says anybody who gets angry with his brother without cause is guilty of breaking the commandment, thou shalt not kill. So if you do not have adequate cause for anger, then you sin. But that's not what Ephesians is talking about. When he says, be angry and sin not, he gives you the next phrase that tells you what he means. Be angry and sin not. Do not let the sun go down upon your wrath. That's the way you keep from sinning. Obviously, you're going to get upset over some of the things that people say or do. And there's something wrong with you if you don't get upset. But be sure that you handle it. Don't nurse it. Now, don't harbor it in your heart. Be sure you've gotten rid of it by the time you go to bed. Get it out of your system. That's the way you keep from sinning. Well, that's your problem, isn't it? Jeremiah didn't get it out of his system. It stayed in his system. And this kind of anger is like poison. If you get a little bit of it in your system, your body can take care of it. But you get a lot of it in your system and all kinds of things start going wrong. So don't let it stay with you. What can you do to get rid of it? Well, Jeremiah tries a very important way, and it's very effective for him. He takes it to God, his hostilities. And he takes it to God. He doesn't see anything wrong with it. He doesn't say, Lord, help me love my enemies. But the very exercising of this and taking it to God and discussing it with God helps Jeremiah get rid of some of this. Just taking it to God. But, of course, you readily understand if you have these kind of hostilities and you take them to God, this doesn't always take care of it. Because even while you're asking God to keep you from being so hostile, even in your prayers, the hostility arises and you still feel this way. The devil even uses your prayers against you sometimes. And your prayers become the occasion whereby you become more conscious than ever of your hostilities. You don't always get rid of them by taking them to God. Another thing you can do is to go to your enemy who's done this to you and see if you can work it out. Sometimes you can. Most of the time you cannot. Most of the time you end up with more hostility than you had before because of the attitude you had toward your extension of friendship, and you end up with more problems than you had before you went to him. And all of us have tried taking it to God and taking it to our enemies without much success. But there's a way that I've found that is almost always successful. And that is, you work it off. You work it off. It's easier to do it by some kind of manual labor, where you can get your mind, you know, in neutral, and just sweat it off in some kind of work, and in the garden, or if you're other things that you do. Some women go on shopping sprees to get rid of it. There are all kinds of ways. Some preachers tell me they play golf. Now, I play golf, but not the way these preachers say they do. Playing golf helps me get rid of these things, but not the way they say. These preachers, I've heard them preach on it. What they play golf is, when they play golf, they put a deacon's name on the golf ball. When they hit it, you know, that's that deacon, and that way they get rid of their frustrations and hostilities. Now, that may be very helpful to you when it comes to getting rid of your hostility, but it doesn't help your golf game. if you've played golf at all, you know that there isn't any way that you can force a golf ball to do what you want it to do. I decided years ago that the golf ball is bound to be feminine gender. Because there isn't any way that by force you can make it do anything. That you have to find out how it wants to be treated. And if you find out how it wants to be treated and do it that way, you get all kinds of cooperation. But you're not going to force it. It doesn't help your golf game. And I have new frustrations when I try this, you know, trying to beat that golf ball into submission. And frustrations about golf can be more serious than anything else in life. So that doesn't work. I don't try that method. I go to play golf and forget about the other problems, and the troubles on the golf course are so much more severe than anything in life. It makes those other things seem to be relatively unimportant. But Jeremiah develops definite hostilities toward his enemies in this process, and some hostility toward God for getting him into it. So what's happening is that he wants to get away. He's feeling sorry for himself. He's complaining. He's developing hostilities. Now, how is this going to be resolved? Let's see. Well, the most important thing to notice about the confessions of Jeremiah is that they are prayers. They are addressed to God. Jeremiah is taking it to God. Now, some people, when they get in this kind of despondency, do something that Jeremiah didn't do. Not only do they want to get away from responsibility, they want to get away from God, who's gotten them into this. And they tend to run away from God. Jeremiah does not do this. He doesn't run away from God. He takes it to God. And if you take your problems to God, you are well on your way toward that solution. Not in the way you think perhaps it may happen, but if you'll take it to God, things are going to find a solution. And Jeremiah takes it to God, expresses to God how he really feels. And this is Jeremiah's subtlest problem, as someone has said. Jeremiah settled this problem on his knees, which is the only way you're really going to get it settled, is by taking it to God. And he forces his opinions and attitudes and hostilities. He takes them to God. He unloads them. And then, of course, if you're going to do this and you're going to be frank and open with God, don't be surprised if God doesn't confront you with the truth about yourself, which may turn out to be very, very surprising. So Jeremiah is going to be open and frank with God, and so God is going to confront him with the truth about the situation. And God has two suggestions to make to him, primarily. The first is in chapter 12 of Jeremiah. After Jeremiah is complaining about the prosperity of the wicked and how these people have just about taken him to the slaughterhouse, and he doesn't know why God isn't at work, and God says to him, chapter 12, verse 5, "If you have raced with men on foot, and they have wearied you, how will you compete with horses? If in a safe land you fall down, how will you do in the jungle of the Jordan?" As somebody has said, God said to him, "Jeremiah, cheer up. The worst is yet to come." He said, if you can't get through this little problem you're having, what are you going to do when it comes to Zedekiah's reign? I mean, it's going to get worse, Jeremiah. Now, this is sort of a stoic way to approach the subject, but it's very realistic. If you can't get through the little crises, don't you expect to be able to meet the big one when it comes? If you think you're having problems in the seminar, you just wait until you have a full-time pastor. If you think you're having problems here, just wait until you get on the mission field. If you can't meet your problems here, don't you think for a moment that by some miracle of God, you're going to meet them over there. But cheer up. The worst is yet to come. If you can't get through the problems you're having now as a young person, what will you do when you get married and have young people of your own? Well, what do you do? It's going to get worse. The problems of life are going to get worse. They're going to be more severe as time goes by. And if you don't meet them now, you're not going to be prepared for what comes. This is very sound advice, and God reminds him that it's not time to get discouraged. It's going to get harder, and he'd better tighten his belt and get ready. But that's not the main thing he told him. The main thing he told him was in chapter 15. Chapter 15, look at verses 15 through 18. Verses 15 through 18 of Jeremiah 15. I want you to take your pen or your pencil now, and in those verses 15 through 18, if you haven't done it yet, take your pen or pencil and circle the number of times that Jeremiah uses the first person. The number of times he uses me, my, or I want you to circle it, and I want you to count it. See how many times. Verses 15 through 18. How many do you get? Some translations have 18, some have less, some have more, but approximately 18. 18 times. Now, mind you, 18 times in four verses he uses first person. It's not hard to figure out what's wrong. He is saying, look at what is happening to me. See? All right, now how's God going to answer that one? Verse 19, therefore, thus says the Lord. He's going to answer that one. If you turn around, if you repent, that's your Hebrew word shuv, to turn around, change your direction. If you repent, I will restore you, and you shall stand before me. To stand before God is a technical Hebrew expression, you know, to serve him in an intimate way. If you were a servant of the king, you know, in the case of Esther, you know, she was afraid to come before the king because if you're not invited, it costs you your life if he doesn't accept you. But there were certain people who were permitted to come into the court, you know, without announcement because of their relationship to the king, his intimate ministers, and priests of the Old Testament and prophets are said to stand before God. And so Jeremiah is about to lose his position as a prophet. He said, if you turn around, I will restore you and you shall stand before me. You can function as a prophet. If you utter what is precious and not what is worthless, you shall be as my mouth. He says, if you start, said anybody, he said, anybody, when the going gets hard, can quit. He said, that's just common language. But this kind of language you have is anybody can say. But he says, that worthless sort of drivel that's been coming out of your mouth, you're going to have to quit that. Because if you don't change that attitude of yours, you are through as a prophet. What he means by this is that if you are trying to serve God in the world, there's one luxury that you cannot afford, and that is a thin skin. If you can't take mistreatment, if you can't take misunderstanding, if you cannot stand persecution, then you'd better stay out of it. It's like Harry Truman said, if you can't stand the heat, then get out of the kitchen. If you're not prepared to be rejected, if you're not prepared for people to misunderstand you and hate you and fight you and try to destroy you, then there's no place for you in God's ministry. You've got to be prepared for the hard road. He said, Jeremiah, there's one thing you can't afford. You can't afford this attitude because when a person is in the ministry of God, he's concerned primarily about getting his job done, not what people are doing to him. A friend of mine was chaplain in the prayer troop corps. He wondered about how the commander worked with these men. So one day he said to the commander, how do you work with these fellows? The commander said, well, you know, All of my men are volunteers. They're not drafted for this branch of service. They have to volunteer for it. They know what they're getting into before they come. Then he said, when they come to me the first day, I say to them, now men, it is not necessary that you be spared. It is only necessary that you complete your mission. Now, unconsciously, that command had caught the very spirit of Christianity. Well, what happens to you is not that important. That you get done what you're supposed to do is that important. When you are more concerned about what's happening to you than you are getting done what God has called you to do, well, then you've become disqualified as God's representative. Those who represent God in the world must be first of all concerned about what God has sent them to do. And God says, Jeremiah, your concern and over anxious attitude toward yourself, what's happening to you, is about to disqualify you as one of my servants. Get that out of your system or you're through. That's a hard word. But it's the truth. God lets him have it. And Jeremiah decides that he's going to stick to this thing. And nothing, no matter how difficult it gets, will ever drive him out of seeking to do God's will. They can kill him. They can reject him. They can despise him. But he'll still be in there slugging away, doing what under God he knows he must do. Well, we'll look at the potter and the clay in chapter 18 and its implications for our lectures on tomorrow. Chapter 18, the implications of chapter 18 will take us the whole period. Thank you very much.